Hello and welcome to In Historia Medicinae. I am Dr. Ashwini Nathu. For new medical students entering into their first year, the whole experience is very exciting. But there's this one thing that inspires the most excitement, trepidation, curiosity, and a little bit of fear: anatomy lab, also known as the human dissection class. Every year, thousands of students around the world learn about the intricacies of the human body in the most hands-on way possible by dissecting an actual human cadaver. Even those of us not related to the medical field are no strangers to dissections or autopsies. We have all watched at least one medical or forensic drama on TV. But what is so normalized for us now has gone through a lot of challenges through the course of history. To understand the history of human dissection, we will be traveling back to the ancient world, ancient Greece to be exact. Death and the concept of afterlife has always been a mystery for humans since prehistoric times. The human body has been considered sacred, and violation of burial sites or memorials to ancestors was considered not just a crime, but a sin. With this background, it's no surprise that human dissections were forbidden in the ancient world. The ancient Egyptians had a limited knowledge of the internal organs due to their elaborate mummification practices, but this knowledge was ritualistic rather than scientific. In ancient Greece, at about 400 BC, Hippocrates, the father of modern medicine, was the first to propose that diseases are not a result of curses or punishments by the gods, but in fact are caused by various natural factors. But all of the medical knowledge imparted in his treatises was based only on observation of the external signs and symptoms of the patients without any attempt at dissection. Ancient Greeks adopted the Hippocratic school of medicine, and it remained the prevalent base of medical knowledge for centuries. 100 years after Hippocrates, that is in the 3rd century BC, two Greek physicians, Herophilus and Erasistratus, were the first to conduct detailed postmortem dissections at the medical school in Alexandria. At that time, Alexandria, Egypt, was the foremost center for culture, science, and learning, and it was a melting pot of intellectuals from different cultures. Therefore, despite the overall religious and moral taboos, these two physicians were allowed to work in a spirit of scientific advancement. They enjoyed royal patronage and were given permission to dissect the bodies of executed criminals. But this progress was quite short-lived, and the post-mortem examinations declined after the deaths of Herophilus and Erasistratus. The rival schools of thought prevailed and declared that dissection provides no useful knowledge at all. The final nail in the coffin was burning of Alexandria in 389 AD. Next came Galen, who lived in the 2nd century AD, and that is 500 years after Hippocrates. He made vast contributions to anatomy and understanding the workings of the circulatory, nervous, and respiratory systems of the human body. Yet, none of his dissection work was done on human cadavers. He primarily used a species of monkeys called Barbary apes due to their similarity to the human form. He also used other mammals like pigs. Galen's knowledge was considered as the apex of ancient Greek medicine, the foundation of which had been laid by Hippocrates. Galen's theories and philosophy became so widely and deeply rooted that it became the sole authority on medicine in the Western world for the next 1400 years. It traveled to the Middle East and is reflected in the Arabic medical treatises from the 9th and the 10th century AD. Meanwhile, in India, an important ancient medical treatise, the Sushrut Samhita, talks in detail about embryology, anatomy of various organs, bones, muscles, as well as various surgical techniques. It highlights the importance of dissecting and studying from a cadaver for the medical students. It also talks about students practicing their surgical skills on fruits, vegetables, as well as on dead animals. The exact age of this treatise cannot be determined, but The oldest surviving copy is from the mid-9th century AD. But later, dissection practices fell out of favor as rigid religious rules were put into place and touching or tampering with dead bodies was considered an absolute taboo. In Europe too, with the rise of the Roman Catholic Church, human dissection was prohibited. And for 1400 years, medical science comprised of physicians following Galen to the T without any challenge. It was high time for an upgrade, but we needed the Renaissance and a Renaissance man to finally achieve it. In the 12th and 13th century, many universities were set up in Europe. The church and the European royalty supported the advancement of science, and the taboo around human dissection started to decline. In the year 1231, the Holy Roman Emperor, Frederick II, decreed that a human dissection should be performed at least every 5 years and that attendance must be compulsory for every student who wished to practice medicine or surgery. So the university started conducting demonstrations of human dissections using bodies of executed criminals. These were public affairs conducted in amphitheater-like halls which were open for everyone, and not just scientific demonstrations for medical students. The professor of medicine conducting the dissection would stand on a high platform and read out one of the ancient texts of Hippocrates or Galen. An assistant would point to each organ as the professor read out the description, while the actual dissection was done by a barber surgeon. The medical professors thought that it was below the dignity of their office and their knowledge to actually perform the dissection. In these demonstrations, there was absolutely no attempt to verify or study the findings by themselves. It was just blindly following the word of the ancient texts. Such dissection demonstrations were held only once or twice in a year. So the medical students had to rely on other means to obtain cadavers for their own studies. They resorted to braving wild animals to go outside the city limits where the bodies of the criminals were left to decompose. They also tried to pay for the funerals of the deceased in the local families so that it encouraged them to volunteer their deceased for dissection. This was the landscape when our Renaissance man, Analius, entered the University of Paris. He was Dutch and he came from a long line of prominent physicians. Though the laws in France were pretty progressive with regards to human dissection, Vesalius had to resort to the same means as the other medical students to obtain the cadavers. But he was a keen anatomist and a prodigy. He was appointed as a lecturer of anatomy and surgery at the University of Padua in Italy at the young age of 22. In his dissection demonstrations, he ditched the high lectern and stepped onto the dissection floor. He took the knife and began dissecting and demonstrating by himself. He prided himself on his dissection skills and did not consider it as lowering his prestige as a medical man. He conducted numerous dissections and recorded his observations in great detail. He also documented them as a series of woodcuts with help from pupils of the master painter Titian. Around the same time period, artists like Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo were also studying human anatomy to make their artwork more lifelike. After a few dissections, Vesalius, he realized that Galen had gotten a few things right, but there were many things that he had gotten completely wrong, and he believed in calling a spade a spade. He realized that Galen had done most of his dissection work on animals and extrapolated the results to humans. There were major discrepancies in his descriptions, but the funny thing was that for almost 1.5 millennia, anatomists had gone on blindly following Galen, claiming to find organs and structures which aren't even present in the humans, all because they didn't want to be the ones to upset the Galenic apple cart. Vesalius was not just a yes man. He collected his findings and published them as the treatise De Humani Corporis Fabrica, or On the Fabric of the Human Body. He gave new insights on the anatomy and physiology of various organ systems and also debunked more than 200 of Galen's claims. He was just 28 years old. And of course, like any revolutionary, he was staunchly opposed by the traditionalists, the Galenists. So much so that his own teachers, who had once praised him to be a promising student, were now rallying against him. But that there wasn't much that they could do, since Vesalius had irrevocably demonstrated all his findings by doing actual dissections. He also encouraged his students to do the same, to perform their own dissections and confirm his findings for themselves. Finally, the Galenists had to resign themselves by saying that the human body had probably changed since Galen's times. Tired of all this opposition, Vesalius left the university and went into the service of Charles V as the court physician. Despite his early retirement from academia, Vesalius had revolutionized the study of human anatomy. Many anatomists were inspired to conduct their own dissections and record their findings, but the problem was obtaining the cadavers. It was relatively easy in France, as well as in Italy, for members of the medical fraternity. But in England, it was difficult to destigmatize the use of human cadavers and to change the public opinion. But the demand from anatomists and medical schools was rising. In a bid to solve this problem, England passed the Murder Act in 1752. It stated that murderers were to be executed and that their bodies would be provided to medical schools for dissection. The government thought that this would also add and serve as a deterrent to criminals because, in people's minds, the thought of their bodies being dissected was a greater punishment than the actual execution. So much so that there were few incidents of rioting by the family and friends of executed criminals to stop the bodies from reaching the medical college. This act did not help as much as anticipated, as there were hardly a dozen executions each year. Even the deterrent value was short-lived, and on the contrary, it led to a flourishing underground business for grave diggers and body snatchers who made a quick buck by selling bodies and body parts to the anatomists. The grave robbing and the body snatching went to such an extent that people started resorting to keeping vigils or hiring security guards to guard the graves of their loved ones. They also resorted to devices like mortuary safes or large stone slabs to protect the fresh graves. Mortuary safes were large iron cages which were placed over the grave. An option was to place a heavy stone slab over a fresh grave. These mortuary safes or stone slabs were removed after a few weeks once the body was sufficiently decomposed so that it was of no more interest to the anatomist. We have to bear in mind that this was prior to refrigeration technology, where the body could be of use only for a few days or a week to the anatomists to study the internal structures. Then, suddenly, body snatching wasn't even the main problem. It escalated to kidnapping and murder. There were many instances of criminals making quick money by this technique, but the most famous or infamous are the deadly duo of Burke and Hare. They ran a boarding house in Tanner's Close, Edinburgh. One of their lodgers died suddenly in his room of natural causes, but he owed the duo some money. So they hit upon this idea to sell his body to the local anatomist. They found that a body sold for about 8 to 10 pounds, which was a princely sum for that time. Most of their lodgers were poor and had no family or relations. So these two figured that they had a gold mine. They would start by getting the victim intoxicated. Then Burke would sit on their chest while Hare dragged them around the room by their hands or legs. The victim died of mechanical asphyxiation. That is a form of choking caused by failure of the lungs and the chest wall to expand. They killed 16 people in all, over a span of a year between 1827 and 1828. Finally, someone got suspicious of their activities and informed the police. They were caught and charged with these murders. Hare turned against Burke and testified in exchange of a lenient sentence. Burke was proven guilty, executed, and then dissected, just like his victims. And burking was established as a term for mechanical asphyxiation by chest wall compression. Similar cases came to light in UK and US, which raised public opinion about the need for cadavers for medical education and research. This compelled the British Parliament to pass the Anatomy Act in 1832. This authorized the use of unclaimed bodies after 48 hours of death and ended the use of executed criminals as subjects for dissections. In the present day, most of the bodies used for medical purposes are willingly donated. Donating our body to science is now no longer a taboo, but a celebrated cause. Many 3D and virtual reality programs are also being developed to augment the learning experience. But it will be many, many decades, at the least, before technology replaces the actual thing. The whole furor about the use of human cadavers for dissection may not seem very relevant in modern times, but Vesalius's scientific temperament is certainly relevant, even more so in the face of the constant barrage of information and misinformation reaching us via the infinite media sources. It would benefit us all to remember to take everything with a pinch of salt, instead of believing all that is told to us. As Vesalius proved, seeing is believing. Or as kids say nowadays, photos or it didn't happen. Thank you for listening to In Historia Medicinae, a brief history of medicine with me, Dr. Ashwini Nathu. You can email us at abriefhistoryofmedicine@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Instagram. Our handle is A Brief History of Medicine. Thank you very much for listening.